In creating the Riddermark, Tolkien thought of his own Mercia. He also remembered the great lost romance of Gothia, of the close kin of the English turning to the disaster and oblivion on the plains of Russia. No doubt he knew the dim tradition that the word Goths itself meant horse folk. This is what adds reconstruction to calking and produces fantasy, a people in a culture that never were, but that press closer and closer to the edge of what might have been. The riders gain life from their mixture of homely, almost hobbitic familiarity with a strong dash of something completely alien. Éomer is a nice young man, but there is a streak of nomad ferocity in the way he and his men taunt Aragorn and the company with their narrowing circle of horses and Éomer's silent advance until the point of his spear was within a foot of Aragorn's breast. They behave like mail-shirted Sioux or Cheyenne, and, like the Middle-earth Deerslayer, Aragorn did not stir, recognizing the nomad appreciation of impassivity. All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Yes, we are. We've got book two, chapter three, Riders of the Rohan.
Dude, this is up here for, this is up there with my favorite chapters of Fellowship, I must say.
Okay.
The land descriptions were on point, to the point where we have too many that we can't read them all.
Yeah, oh, this one's pretty awesome. If you had to peg one place you've been to that captures the geography here, the topography, what would it be? To me, it feels a little bit like Badlands.
Oh, what's Rohan? Oh.
Or at least this part they've been running through.
Probably like Switzerland in front of the Alps.
Yeah? You think there's mountains in the background that are this intense? That intense,
yeah.
Rather?
Yeah, well, far away the White Mountains to the south, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds, I would buy that.
And it's got some like lush, like rolling hills a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, maybe like northern Italy or something, like also, yes, foothills of the Alps.
Yeah.
And I just love the imagery of like the steppe with like the rock formations jutting out of the rolling plains.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, Wyoming, the lush parts of Wyoming could work as opposed to like deserty stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, all right, hold on. But we'll get to, like, I guess we can sparse that crap in.
Yes.
So today, it's chapter two of book two. I guess I said chapter three. Whoops.
Oh, yeah. I read that. My mistake.
Chapter two of book two of... No, I have it backwards. It's chapter two of book three, The Two Towers, right? Okay, so that's where I screwed up. And so, obviously, we got to talk about this new land that our heroes are just traversing across, running across, as you probably could tell by the song that I chopped in there at the beginning. We got to talk about the Riders of Rohan, who they meet, and then we got to talk about what they think's going on with their missing companions. And then, as a special treat slash pretty big avoidable tangent that we will hit, we're going to do a movie review of one of my favorite movies, Chariots of Fire, purely because it's loosely connected to the running scene, but then I think it could also shed some light on 1920s Tolkien life.
Okay, that's actually two connections.
I know, right?
Well, so relevant.
The one comes because I'm obviously just chopping in Chariots of Fire. Like, I must have been doing it already. How can I resist?
Mm-hmm.
That's up there for greatest theme songs ever. But we'll get there. We'll get there soon. We got to blow through the, you know, part that's part of, like, the actual Tolkien podcast. You know, the Tolkien-specific stuff. I guess.
Yes.
I mean, it's our show. We could do whatever. But, yeah, we'll do that first. All right, so Cliff's notes. Bring it on.
Okay, so we left Legolas, Aragorn, and Gimli by themselves, set off running in the night, chasing the orcs who they believe have taken Merry and Pippin. They continue to pursue the orcs' trail, although the orcs seem to be moving really quickly. They follow them for 3 days, and although they continue to find signs along the way, scraps, clues, they feel like they're losing them. On the third day, when they've kind of given up hope, and they have done a little detective work along the way, but they feel like they're giving up hope, the orcs are moving too fast, they see horse riders in the distance approaching quickly, and suddenly they're surrounded by basically a mounted army, or a garrison perhaps. It turns out to be the riders of the Rohan, who are not explicitly friendly, but I think Aragorn convinces them that they're fighting on the same side. And at the end, the riders give them horses, and they set off to continue their pursuit of the orcs. However, they are thrown off their quest at the very end of the chapter.
Mm. All right. So when the riders are approaching, they almost gave up hope, I think, but I don't think Aragorn ever gave up hope throughout this chapter, I'd say.
No, not in a they thought they were going to die sort of way when the riders were coming, but more they knew that they were losing the orcs before the riders showed up. The orcs were moving too fast.
No, but Gimli gives up hope thinking like Merry and Pippin are dead, whereas Aragorn never does.
Right, that's correct. I just meant that they feel like they thought they could chase him down, just running after him, and they are losing ground throughout the whole time.
See, I listened to Cliff Notes this time.
Yeah, good for
look
you.
Look at me. Okay, all right. So yeah, we gotta blow through some stuff here because this is this is a big chapter with like lots of details, lots of cool details. So let's just hit it. Okay, so that afternoon they had just sent off Boromir down the river, and so they run through the night and making their way through Emyn Muil, like the edges of it. They're searching and they come across the body of 5 dead orcs. Aragorn notices that they're all northern orcs, so he thinks a quarrel broke out among the group.
They're none of the larger orcs that have the mark of the hand of Saruman on them, right?
Right. So TBD on that. This narrating gets me super pumped up, but it'd be impractical to quote every single cool thing because that's most of the chapter. But let's read this Dawn quote and Aragorn's song.
Swiftly now the pursuers turned and followed the new path. As if fresh from a night's rest, they sprang from stone to stone. At last they reached the crest of the grey hill, and a sudden breeze blew in their hair and stirred their cloaks, the chill wind of dawn. Turning back, they saw across the river the far hills kindled. Day leaped into the sky. The red rim of the sun rose over the shoulders of the dark land. Before them, in the west, the world lay still, formless and grey. But even as they looked, the shadows of night melted, the colors of the waking earth returned. Green flowed over the wide meads of Rohan, and the white mist shimmered in the water vales. And far off to the left, 30 leagues or more, blue and purple stood the white mountains, rising into peaks of jet, tipped with glimmering snows, flushed with the rose of morning.
"Gondor, Gondor," cried Aragorn, "would that I looked on you again in a happier hour. Not yet does my road lie southwards to your bright streams. Gondor, Gondor, between the mountains and the sea. West wind blew there, the light upon the silver tree. Fell like the bright rain in gardens of the kings of old. O proud walls, white towers, O winged crowns and throne of gold. O Gondor, Gondor, men shall behold the silver tree, or west wind blow between the mountains and the sea." "Now let us go," he said, drawing his eyes away from the south and looking out west and north to the way that he must tread. This is the part that reminded me of the foothills or the Switzerland.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay, so anyways, they come to the edge of this big shelf, which is the end of the Emyn Muil, because that was kind of like the hills, but it all just suddenly drops with a big, huge fall. And so this is the eastern border of Rohan. They see another eagle, and across the plain, Legolas thinks he can see a great company on foot 12 leagues ahead. Jeez. That's such a big lead. How much is 12 leagues?
Well, if you remember, a league is 3 miles. So 12 leagues is 36 miles.
Yeah, so 36 mile lead, holy crap. So
first of all, Legolas can see that far.
Well, they wasted... Oh, well, he sounded out pipe, but yeah, I agree. But they wasted hours burying Boromir and trying to figure everything out. And then throughout the night, it's hard to track stuff at night, even if you're the best tracker in the world, which is what Aragorn is. But, you know, he had to track their way through the whole time, so that probably slowed him down, whereas the orcs are just faster to begin with, and they know where they're going, you know. So this is how they got such a big lead. Okay, they find a way down the shelf, and they set foot in Rohan. And then it's a cool description of that. You want to read that one?
Sure. "At the bottom, they came with a strange suddenness on the grass of Rohan. It swelled like a green sea up to the very foot of the Emyn Muil. The falling stream vanished into a deep growth of cresses and water plants, and they could hear it tinkling away into green tunnels, down long, gentle slopes towards the fens of Entwash Vale far away. They seemed to have left winter clinging to the hills behind. Here the air was softer and warmer and faintly scented, as if spring was already stirring and the sap was flowing again in herb and leaf. Legolas took a deep breath, like one that drinks a great draught after a long thirst in barren places.
"Ah, the green smell," he said. "It is better than much sleep. Let us run."
"Light feet may run swiftly here," said Aragorn. "More swiftly, maybe, than iron-shod orcs. Now we have a chance to lessen their lead."
Okay, so hopefully this works out. We'll see. But anyways, they're running along, and Aragorn sees some hobbit footprints that kind of divert off the main trample way that the orcs have been producing this whole time. I'll take Aragorn here. "Yes," he said. "They are quite plain, the hobbit's footprints. Pippin's, I think. He is smaller than the other. And look at this." He held up a thing that glittered in the sunlight. It looked like the new opened leaf of a beech tree, fair and strange, in that treeless plain.
"The brooch of an elven cloak," cried Legolas and Gimli together.
"Not idly do the leaves of Lorien fall," said Aragorn. "This did not drop by chance. It was cast away as a token to any that might follow. I think Pippin ran away from the trail for that purpose."
"Then at least he was alive," said Gimli. "And he had use of his wits, and of his legs, too. That is heartening. We do not pursue in vain." "Let us hope he did not pay too dearly for his boldness," said Legolas. "Come, let us go on. The thought of those merry young folk driven like cattle burns my heart."
I like that last line by Legolas. The merry young folk, and he doesn't want to see him get hurt, you know?
Right. Although, it's a kind of a funny detail that Legolas, who's a wood elf coming from the forest in the north, is using it saying, "I hate to see these guys driven like cattle," as though suddenly he's taken on a cowboy persona being in the grasslands. Anyways, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so night comes again. And he just keeps stepping up his epic descriptions of dawn and noon and sunset and everything. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of, like, Homer or Dante. I've been reading Dante lately. Dante will take, like, 10 lines to say, yeah, it was dawn. But, I mean, it's cool. I don't quite understand it fully without an explanation, but it's cool. And then Homer had, like, he had lines to say, like, it was dawn. Epic lines to say that all the time, too. Okay, so Aragorn says now they have a choice. They either run through the night while their drive is still hot to not rest and keep... you know, just keep going, or they do rest for the night and conserve strength. Gimli needs rest at some point, and he says night's the best time because it's hard to see the trail, you know, at night. But Legolas really wants to keep going.
And for what it's worth, we've talked before, Legolas and elves don't really sleep, right? They just kind of, they prefer to walk through the forest and see, look at the stars at night, right?
We haven't really talked about this. I think but we'll see, like, yeah, Legolas doesn't sleep these next couple nights. I think if they're in a nice, fair land, then just walking around or stargazing or just soaking in the land is sleep enough. But, you know, when they're in, like, Moria or something, you know, he's probably actually sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Like
okay.
The place that's, like, not accustomed for elves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, they give the choice to Aragorn. Should I claim Aragorn? Should I just keep being Aragorn?
Sure, where are we?
"You give the choice to an ill chooser," said Aragorn. "Since we passed through the Argonath, my choices have gone amiss." He fell silent, gazing north and west into the gathering night for a long while. "We will not walk into the dark," he said at length. "The peril of missing the trail or signs of other coming and goings seems to me the greater. If the moon gave enough light, we would use it. But alas, it sets too early and is yet young and pale."
"And tonight he is shrouded anyway," Gimli muttered. "Would that the lady had given us a light, such as a gift as she gave to Frodo."
"It will be more needed where it is bestowed," said Aragorn. "With him lies the true quest. Ours is but a small matter in the great deeds of this time. A vain pursuit from the beginning, maybe, which no choice of mine can mar or mend. Well, I have chosen, so let us take the time as best we may." Kind of cool lines. You know, Aragorn really just steps up his just noble responses in this chapter, too. Mm-hmm. Actually, maybe he's always had that, but he just has a bunch of good responses here throughout, as we'll highlight.
Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting reflection also from him, noting that this is a minor and maybe vain quest, and we have to remember how much more important Frodo's quest is.
Right, yep. Okay, so Legolas, he stands gazing northwards all night, Aragorn wakes up before dawn, and then Legolas has that line, you want to read it?
"They are far, far away. I know in my heart that they have not rested this night. Only an eagle could overtake them now."
"Nonetheless, we will still follow as we may," said Aragorn.
So this is kind of what I meant before. This they feel it slipping out of their hands, but Aragorn is undaunted, wants to press on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's really without saying like, okay, yeah, once they get there, what do three do versus 100?
Right. Of course.
Okay. They talk it going on, but Gimli says it's still night and they can't see anything. So this is the part, you see it in the movie a little bit, this is how they open with it. Aragorn stoops to the ground and he can hear what the earth is telling him. And he can tell that the enemy's far away, but there are also loud hooves of horses. So somehow he's like, he can tap into the ground and just hear what's going on for miles. That's just kind of his power. It's a good it's a good little paragraph to read, cool, but we don't have the time. I like that stuff though, that those are token details.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they stop at dusk again. Legolas still regrets that they lost times. The orcs are, like, way gone at this point. Like, now it really is, you know. I mean, it's impressive what Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are doing, but they really don't even have a prayer to catch them. Okay, Aragorn says that there's something strange on the land that's making him weary, but they'll stop for the night again because the moon's going down. So they won't even have any sort of moonlight now. Mm-hmm. So, interesting that the land's making them weary. I think we'll have to come back to that, probably not in this chapter, but somewhere else. They find a spot where the orcs took a break, but that was a day and a half ago, according to Aragorn, like 36 hours. And it seems the orcs are making their way towards Fangorn Forest, which is also the way towards Isengard.
Mm-hmm. And there is brief mention that when Aragorn feels that the land is making him weary, that Legolas and Aragorn mention Saruman and feel that he's working some magic on the land.
Yeah. Saruman's definitely the worry here. Mm-hmm. But then the Riders of Rohan themselves, like, we'll get into it in a little bit, but we're not even sure, based on everything we've heard in Fellowship, the offhand references to Rohan, we're not quite sure where they stand.
They're wild cards.
Yeah. So anyways, let's keep going here.
The sun was sinking when at last they drew near to the end of the line of downs. For many hours they had marched without rest. They were going slowly now, and Gimli's back was bent. Stone hard are the dwarves in labor or journey, but this endless chase began to tell on him, as all hope failed in his heart. Aragorn walked behind him, grim and silent, stooping now and again to scan some print or mark upon the ground. Only Legolas still stepped as lightly as ever, his feet hardly seeming to press the grass, leaving no footprints as he passed. But in the waybread of the elves he found all the sustenance that he needed, and he could sleep, if sleep it could be called by men, resting his mind in the strange paths of elvish dreams, even as he walked open-eyed in the light of the world.
So that's kind of some insight into, I don't know, how Legolas is maintaining his energy this whole time. Seems like the Lembas bread is helping him out the most, but of course notable that on journeys like this, this is when that stuff's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you need to get you through.
And I really like that line. Resting his mind in the strange paths of elvish dreams, even as he walked open-eyed.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I was trying to describe is, like, we don't really consider it sleep, but for the elves and for Legolas, this is something otherworldly relationship to exhaustion and rest.
Right.
The night grew ever colder. Aragorn and Gimli slept fitfully, and whenever they awoke, they saw Legolas standing beside them, or walking to and fro, singing softly to himself in his own tongue. And as he sang, the white stars opened in the hard black vault above. So the night passed. Together they watched the dawn grow slowly in the sky, now bare and cloudless, until at last the sunrise came. It was pale and clear. The wind was in the east, and all the mists had rolled away. Wide lands lay bleak about them in the bitter light. Ahead and eastward they saw the windy uplands of the Wold of Rohan, and they had already glimpsed many days ago from the great river. Northwestward stalked the dark forest of Fanghorn. Still 10 leagues away stood its shadowy eaves, and its further slopes faded into distant blue. Beyond there glimmered far away, as if floating on a grey cloud, the white head of tall Methedras, the last peak of the Misty Mountains. Out of the forest the Entwash flowed to meet them, its stream now swift and narrow, and its banks deep cloven. The orc trail turned from the downs toward it.
So, good bit of geography there. You know what's kind of funny is we keep going through all this stuff, it's like, man, it's very impressive how far they've trucked through, even though they're not even closing on the orcs. But then you just keep hearing, like, yeah, but Fangorn was still 10 leagues away.
Mm-hmm.
It's just demoralizing, you know?
Right. Thank you. So as Aragorn's surveying the land, he sees a blur moving across the land. Legolas, whose eyes are stunningly sharp, sees that they're horsemen. 105, right, to be exact.
Right. And they're still five leagues away at this point. Because they are at a hilltop here, so that might be some way how Aragorn can see 15 miles away, I guess. You know, I guess you could see that from the Sears Tower, right?
Yeah, on a clear day.
It's like, well, on a clear day you can see across to Michigan.
Yeah, that's true, which is more than 15 miles, I guess. On a vaguely hazy day you can easily see 15 miles, but that's from the tallest building.
So it looks like they're going in the reverse of the orc trail. And so Aragorn thinks they've probably already met the orcs, but Legolas doesn't see any hobbits with them, so that's bad news bears. They decide to wait for the riders, and then Gimli has that line there. You want to take it?
What do you know of these horsemen, Aragorn? He said. Do we sit here waiting for sudden death?
I have been among them, answered Aragorn. They are proud and willful, but they are true-hearted, generous in thought and deed, bold but not cruel, wise but unlearned, writing no books but singing many songs, after the manner of the children of men before the dark years. But I do not know what has happened here of late, nor in what mind the Rohirrim may now be between the traitor Saruman and the threat of Sauron. They have long been friends of the people of Gondor, though they are not akin to them. It was in forgotten years long ago that Arrow the Young brought them out of the north, and their kinship is rather with Bardings of Dale and with the Beornings of the Wood, among whom may still be seen many men tall and fair, as are the riders of Rohan. At least they will not love the orcs.
But Gandalf spoke of a rumor that they paid tribute to Mordor, said Gimli.
I believe it no more than Boromir did, answered Aragorn.
You will soon learn the truth, said Legolas. Already they approach.
Okay, so we've heard mentions of Rohan and the Fellowship, most notably when Gandalf was recounting his escape from Isengard when Saruman had captured him. He went, the eagle took him to Rohan where he borrowed a horse, but the king didn't greet him warmly. He just said, take a horse and get out. And then he was even more pissed at Gandalf because he took the best horse ever.
Although Gandalf noted that he had been a friend of these people in times past, and had gone there often.
Right. So Aragorn's actually wondering, not really wondering, because Aragorn knows, like, these are true good friends. Like, they'll never abandon, like, the true men of Gondor, just like Boromir would have thought, too. But he admits, like, okay, but we don't quite know what's going on in the land here. But, like, these are good guys through and through. Like, we should be able to trust them. But, you know, Sauron, kind of like a literal devil, you know, and it's just like, okay, the devil keeps trying to, you know, incorporate every single kingdom he can. Or there's Saruman, who's probably loosely connected with Sauron in some evil way, too, you know?
Right,
so it's
right.
Like, one of the two, they're surrounded on either side. This is funny. So in the drafts, we're not going to get into like any sort of actual draft text or anything tonight. But in the original drafts, Rohan, he was thinking when he was sketching out outlines that Rohan were going to be bad guys. When he gets there, all of a sudden, this actually just becomes like a vestigial idea. You know, vestigial, like vestigial organ, like it, it used to be useful, but now it's not. He leaves a rumor of this in. So he says, okay, maybe they're freaked out that they will be bad guys, but then as soon as they meet him, they're good guys, and they actually have lots of basis in ancient mythology and history, and it just becomes like one of Tolkien's greatest sources to tap into for like the rest of the mythology. As we'll get into, I'm not going to reveal what it is just yet.
This is very interesting, and in a weird way, there's some parallels, I think, to when they're going to Lorien, when there's like...
Yeah.
Mystery, confusion, rumors of dangerous things that might happen, and then the riders of the Rohan that we'll see are like, I feel like they it paints a very strong contrast to Lorien. Also mysterious, but this is like, they're wild cards because they're raw, basic, true, not quite the like holy mystique that Lorien has. But interesting parallel.
Yeah, well, let's get into it.
Okay,
the riders ride up. Super cool description of that, but we're going to be quoting a lot of this conversation, so we can't talk about that part. They ride right past because their cloaks are kind of hiding the three of them. So Aragorn has to hail them, and they turn around and surround them.
Well, I feel like we got to give a little bit better description of how cool this entry is. Aragorn stands up, says, "What news of the North, riders?" And they immediately veer around and circle them in, and their circle winds tighter and tighter until all of a sudden they're surrounded and spears are pointed and arrows are, or bows are already drawn with arrows. And that's when Éomer basically dismounts or approaches Aragorn to question them.
All right, nice job, Clifford. You want to take Éomer?
Sure.
Be really stern.
Okay. Who are you, and what are you doing in this land? Said the rider, using the common speech of the West, in manner and tone like to the speech of Boromir, man of Gondor.
I am called Strider, answered Aragorn. I came out of the north. I am hunting orcs.
The rider leapt from his horse. Giving a spear to another who rode up and dismounted at his side, he drew his sword and stood face to face with Aragorn, surveying him keenly and not without wonder. At length he spoke again. At first I thought you yourselves were orcs, he said, but now I see that that is not so. Indeed, you know little of orcs if you go hunting them in this fashion. They were swift and well armed, and there were many. You would have changed from hunters to prey if ever you had overtaken them. But there is something strange about you, Strider. He bent his clear, bright eyes upon the ranger. That is no name for a man that you give. And strange, too, is your raiment. Have you sprung out of the grass? How did you escape our sight? Are you elvish folk?
No, said Aragorn. Only one of us is an elf. Legolas from the Woodland Realm in distant Mirkwood. But we have passed through Lothlorien, and the gifts in favor of the lady go with us.
The rider looked at them with renewed wonder, but his eyes hardened. Then there is a lady in the Golden Wood, as old tales tell, he said. Few escape her nets, they say. These are strange days. But if you have her favor, then you are also net weavers and sorcerers, maybe. He turned a cold glance suddenly upon Legolas and Gimli. Why do you not speak, silent ones? He demanded.
Gimli rose and planted his feet firmly apart. His hands gripped the handle of his axe, and his dark eyes flashed. Give me your name, horse master, and I shall give you mine, and more besides, he said.
As for that, said the rider, staring down at the dwarf, the stranger should declare himself first. Yet I am named Éomer, son of Éomund, and am called the third marshal of Riddermark.
All right, so interesting introduction. At this point, the movie loosely captures it perfectly, just with less lines of how Éomer kind of gets into it with Legolas and Gimli, and they're threatening each other, and they even start to potentially draw weapons. How does this intro with this man compared to any of the ones that we saw in Fellowship, specifically when they met some elves like Gildor or Haldir?
Much tenser.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Aggressive. There's, aggressive.
Although Lorien was particularly tense for a meeting with elves. I think meeting with Gildor, there was some understanding very quickly. When they showed up in Lorien, basically the bows were drawn and they were prepared to, you know, kill the loud-breathing dwarf, etc. Aragorn and Legolas were able to talk everyone down. So this is actually fairly similar to that, I'd say. But this is certainly much more raw. There are no feigning of politeness in this case.
Yeah. Well, I think this is potentially just a straight-up difference between men and elves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we got to get the context of what's going on here in Rohan. So let's keep going with it. Your pardon, Éomer, cried Aragorn. When you know more, you will understand why you have angered my companions. We intend no evil to Rohan, nor to any of its folk, neither to man nor to horse. Will you not hear our tale before you strike?
I will, said Éomer, lowering his blade. But the wanderers in the Riddermark would be wise to be less haughty in these days of doubt. First tell me your right name.
First tell me whom you serve, said Aragorn. Are you friend or foe of Sauron, the Dark Lord of Mordor?
I only serve the Lord of the Mark, Théoden, king, son of Thangel, answered Éomer. We do not serve the power of the Black Land far away, but neither are we yet at open war with him. And if you are fleeing from him, then you had best leave this land. There is trouble now on all our borders, and we are threatened. But we desire only to be free and to live as we have lived, keeping our own and serving no foreign lord, good or evil. We welcomed guests kindly in the better days, but in these times the unbidden stranger finds us swift and hard. Come, who are you? Whom do you serve? At whose command do you hunt orcs in our land?
I serve no man, said Aragorn, but the servants of Sauron I pursue into whatever land they may go. There are few among mortal men who know more of orcs, and I do not hunt them in this fashion out of choice. The orcs whom we pursued took captive two of my friends. In such need, a man that has no horse will go on foot, and he will not ask for leave to follow the trail, nor will he count the heads of the enemy save with a sword. I am not weaponless. Aragorn drew back his cloak. The elven sheath glittered as he grasped it, and the bright blade of Anduril shone like a sudden flame as he wept it out. Elendil, he cried, I am Aragorn, son of Arathorn, and am called Elisar, the elf stone, Dunedain, the heir of Isildur, Elendil, son of Gondor. Here is the sword that was broken and is forged again. Will you aid me or thwart me? Choose swiftly.
Gimli and Legolas looked at their companion in amazement, for they had not seen him in this mood before. He seemed to have grown in stature while Éomer shrunk, and in his living face they caught a brief vision of the power and majesty of the kings of stone. For a moment it seemed to the eyes of Legolas that a white flame flickered on the brows of Aragorn like a shining crown. Éomer stepped back, and a look of awe was in his face. He cast down his proud eyes. "These are indeed strange days," he muttered. "Dreams and legends spring to life out of the grass." "Tell me, lord," he said, "what brings you here, and what was the meaning of the dark words?" Long has Boromir, son of Denethor, been gone seeking an answer, and the horse that we lent him came back riderless. What doom do you bring out of the north?
The doom of choice, said Aragorn. You may say this to Theoden, son of Thangol. Open war lies before you, with Sauron or against him. None may live now as they have lived, and few shall keep what they call their own. But of these great matters we will speak later, if chance allows. I will come myself to the king. Now I am in great need, and I ask for help, or at least for tidings. You heard that we were pursuing an orc host that carried off our friends. What can you tell us? So let's pause here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good introduction here. So we're starting to hear about these Rohan people and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? You give me your thoughts first.
Well, certainly they're holding up to our suspicions that they're kind of raw, rough, and wild cards. They've in many ways framed themselves as free, and they don't want a foreign king, good or evil. It's easy to sympathize with that. I think you could find historical parallels or other stories where you've got people like this, really proud.
Well, and these people are at war, you know, like this is batten down the hatches time. Like, we can't just, borders not open.
Right. Well, yeah, borders are not open, but they note they're not at war yet. So they don't really, it's not a, my enemy of my enemy is my friend.
No.
Aragorn's trying to make that pitch, but they're not too receptive. They're kind of like, well, you're not really looking for trouble and you should get out of here.
Yeah, they're trying to insulate themselves.
But it's really significant that Aragorn, in short terms, basically says, there's no middle ground here. This is a fight between good and evil, and you have to pick a side, and even if you don't pick a side, this war is going to be on top of you before you know it.
He also had one of the really good kingly scenes again, you know, just whipping out the sword, saying, like, the whole lineage right there. That was pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Love all of those scenes.
Probably the most glamorous we've seen Aragorn so far.
Yeah, I think, because some of the other ones, if you're really just zoning out, you can miss them. This one, you absolutely can't miss.
Or the other one's like, you know, he's been given a nice stone by Lady Galadriel, and he's been identified as Elisar, the elf stone. Yeah. This one was the first time where he's like, here's who I am, all the titles, and the sword.
I love Éomer's line. These are indeed strange days. Dreams and legends spring to life out of the grass. And I want to address that a little bit more after we get through a bit more of this speech, too. Or this conversation, too. So Aragorn, again, he was saying, you have heard that we are pursuing an orc host that carried off our friends. What can you tell us?
That you need not pursue them further, said Éomer. The orcs are destroyed.
And our friends?
We found none but orcs.
But that is strange indeed, said Aragorn. Did you search the slain? Were there no bodies other than those of orc kind? They would be small, only children to your eyes, unshod but clad in gray.
There were no dwarves nor children, said Éomer. We counted all the slain and despoiled them. Then we piled the carcasses and burned them, as is our custom. The ashes are smoking still.
We do not speak of dwarves or children, said Gimli. Our friends were hobbits.
Hobbits, said Éomer. And what may they be? It is a strange name.
A strange name for a strange folk, said Gimli. But these were very dear to us. It seems that you have heard in Rohan the words that troubled Minas Tirith. They spoke of the halfling. Those hobbits are halflings.
Halflings, laughed the rider that stood beside Éomer. Halflings. But they are only a little people in old songs and children's tale out of the north. Do we walk in legends or on the green earth in daylight?
A man may do both, said Aragorn. For not we, but those who come after will make the legends of our time. The green earth, you say? That is a mighty matter of legend, though you tread it under the light of day. Okay, so more of this legend stuff again. You know, like, this is what I love about the Riders of Rohan. We know that they're men already, okay, right? So they're normal men, kind of like how Boromir was the normal guy in the Fellowship for us to relate to.
More relatable than Aragorn.
Right, we can relate to the Rohan people just like this. Okay, so what are they? They're in a time of peril. You know, the country's in danger. Their way of life is threatened. Éomer literally said that, and Aragorn said, like, yeah, that's unavoidable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, this weird stuff's just happening, just at, like, what's the word? if they're not at the darkest hour, they're close. Like, we're already starting to get that kind of vibe.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so, like, all of a sudden, like, keep this in mind as we go through all of book three here. Just, these are normal men and all the stuff that they're going to see that happens to them. I love it. Like, mm-hmm, I really, mm-hmm. really love it. And I think we can wait till we get better examples of it, but it's awesome. Like, the Riders of Rohan, normal men, you know, who listened to fairy tales when they were kids, you know, now they're going to just start seeing some. And it's mm-hmm. fun. Like, this is what makes this book exciting. And again, these are the men, these are the normal, rational men that we can relate to, you know, mm-hmm. who are the closest things to us.
Although Aragorn's response right at the end there, I think, is particularly good. He's saying, well, that's not quite the duality or the binary choice you're laying out, like legend versus walking on the green earth, because the green earth itself is the stuff of legend, and you're walking on it right now. So it's kind of an interesting retort, even though it goes unaddressed. Aramir just sort of ignores him. You can easily see Tolkien having that sort of mindset about studying the old stories and myths. Like, is this really just a question of fairy tales versus real life, or all of our fairy tales and mythologies came out of the earth that we live in at some point?
Yeah, Aragorn's just a champ. Every single line he has in this chapter is just excellent. Okay, so I actually have a bunch of notes about Rohan, but let's just do them once we finish this whole conversation, because I got a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, these guys are prime philology stuff. Like, we're gonna go to town on this.
Okay.
Let's keep going here with this conversation. So at this point, Éomer kind of pulls the three aside to talk mm-hmm. privately, stuff that doesn't have to be said in front of literally 100 people, probably to get, you know, some more inside info and, like, you know, butter him mm-hmm. up a little bit. Like, Éomer, he's letting down his guard now, and he's starting to be nicer. You know, he's not as aggressive as he was right from the introduction. Like, I guess he doesn't have to impress his soldiers, and he also understands, like, Aragorn's the real deal. You know, that entrance when he showed the swords, like, this guy's for real.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, Aragorn says that they set out from Imladris with a group, and notably in that group were Boromir and Gandalf. Éomer says he knows Gandalf, and he seems to be a fan of him.
Indeed, since his last coming in the summer, all things have gone amiss. At that time, our trouble with Saruman began. Until then, we counted Saruman our friend, but Gandalf came then and warned us that sudden war was preparing in Isengard. He said that he himself had been a prisoner in Orthanc, and had hardly escaped, and he begged for help. But Théoden would not listen to him, and he went away. Speak not the name of Gandalf loudly in Théoden's ears. He is wroth. For Gandalf took the horse that is called Shadowfax, the most precious of all the king's steeds, chief of the Miras, which only the Lord of the Mark may ride. For the sire of their race was the great horse of Errol that knew the speech of men. 7 nights ago Shadowfax returned, but the king's anger is not less, for now the horse is wild and will let no man handle him.
Okay. That's good details. So, ever since Gandalf showed up last summer, everything's been screwing up since then. So, they've been getting bleaker and bleaker for, I think they're at, like, the end of February now. So, about mm-hmm. 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff's been going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, certainly, their experience would point to suspicious goings-on with Gandalf. But Éomer seems to feel that Gandalf is a good guy, even if Théoden is not happy.
Yeah, Éomer seems to think, like, hey, Gandalf's a good guy, even if bad stuff followed behind him.
Right.
But at this point, Aragorn bursts the bubble that Gandalf's dead, and then he bursts the bubble that Boromir is also dead. When Éomer hears of Boromir's death, what does he say?
Your news is all of woe, cried Éomer in dismay. Great harm is this death to Minas Tirith and to us all. That was a worthy man. All spoke his praise. He came seldom to the mark, for he was ever in the wars on the east borders. But I have seen him. More like to the swift sons of Errol than the grave men of Gondor he seemed to me, and likely to prove a great captain of his people when his time came. But we have had no word of this grief out of Gondor. When did he fall?
It is now the 4th day since he was slain, answered Aragorn. And since the evening of that day we have journeyed from the shadow of Tol Brandir.
On foot? Cried Éomer.
Yes, even as you see us.
Wide wonder came into Éomer's eyes. Strider is too poor a name, son of Arathorn, he said. Wingfoot, I name you. This deed of the three friends shall be sung in many a hall. 40 leagues and 5 you have measured ere the 4th day is ended. Hardy is the race of Elendil. But now, lord, what would you have me do? I must return in haste to Théoden. I spoke wordily before my men. It is true that we are not yet to open war with the Black Land, and there are some, close to the king's ear, that speak craven counsels. But war is coming. We shall not forsake our old alliance with Gondor, and while they fight, we shall aid them. So say I and all who hold with me. The Eastmark is my charge, and the ward of the Third Marshal, and I have removed all our herds and herd folk, withdrawing them beyond Entwash, leaving none here but guards and swift scouts.
Then you do not pay tribute to Sauron, said Gimli?
We do not, and we never have, said Éomer with a flash of his eyes, though it comes to my ears that a lie has been told. Some years ago, the Lord of the Black Land wished to purchase horses of us at great price, but we refused him, for he puts beasts to evil use. Then he sent plundering orcs, and they carry off what they can, choosing always the black horses. Few of these are now left. For that reason, our feud with orcs is bitter. But at this time, our chief concern is with Saruman. He has claimed lordship over all this land, and there has been war between us for many months. He has taken orcs into his service, and wolf riders, and evil men, and he has closed the gap against us, so that we are likely to be beset both east and west. It is ill dealing with such a foe. He is a wizard both cunning and dwemer crafty, having many disguises. He walks here and there, they say, as an old man hooded and cloaked, very like to Gandalf, as many now recall. His spies slip through every net, and his birds of ill omen are abroad in the sky. I do not know how it will all end, and my heart misgives me, for it seems to me that his friends do not all dwell in Isengard. But if you come to the king's house, you shall see more for yourself. Will you not come? Do I hope in vain that you have been sent to me for a help in doubt and need?
I will come when I may, said Aragorn.
Come now, said Éomer. The heir of Elendil would be a strength indeed to the sons of Eorl in this evil tide. There is battle even now upon the west of Met, and I fear that it may go ill for us.
Okay, so that was big. Lots of info right there. So it does seem like they are already at open war with Saruman. And things are looking not great. So they are very, I'd say they are pretty close to midnight of like darkest hour kind of stuff. Éomer, though, he also seems like a pretty upstanding guy. Interesting, he was saying stuff like, it sounds like the king has bad counselors and the king is just in a crappy mood.
Yeah, Éomer was being a little political here. Like, he wanted to talk away from the group because technically the kingdom's not at war yet, but he recognizes that war is coming and sees the dangers at hand, and he's already moved his people in this province basically further to safety and just has guards patrolling the edges. So he, I think, is a little more wary than the official stance of his king.
And he just seems like a good, noble, true guy throughout this speech here.
Definitely.
Trying to do the right thing, trying to protect his people. Sounds a lot like Boromir before he went crazy or something. And, you know, he was initially harsh with them, but now he's warmed up, and probably because Aragorn cooled him over and stuff. But yeah.
And we also learned that Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli ran 45 leagues in 3.5 days, which is 135 miles.
Yeah.
So impressive. It's like running, running 45 miles a day, 3 days in a row is crazy.
Yeah.
Some ultramarathon.
Yeah. Okay, so Éomer talks about how they killed the orc party yesterday at dawn, and he emphasizes how things are getting really desperate against Isengard, and, well, we already heard of that a little bit, and having Aragorn really help in Rohan, but Aragorn says he can't abandon his friends yet, not while hope remains. And then, you know, Éomer is kind of telling him, like, what are you talking about, hope? But do you want to take his line?
Then what do you think has become of them?
I do not know. They may have been slain and burned among the orcs, but that, you will say, cannot be, and I do not fear it. I can only think that they were carried off into the forest before the battle, even before you encircled your foes, maybe. Can you swear that none escaped your net in such a way?
I would swear that no orc escaped after we sighted them, said Éomer. We reached the forest eaves before them, and if after that any living thing broke through our ring, then it was no orc and had some elvish power.
Our friends were attired as we are, said Aragorn, and you passed us by under the full light of day.
I had forgotten that, said Éomer. It is hard to be sure of anything among so many marvels. The world is all grown strange. Elf and dwarf in company walk in our daily fields, and folk speak with the Lady of the Wood and yet live. And the sword comes back to war that was broke in the long ages ere the fathers of our fathers rode into the mark. How shall a man judge what to do in such times?
As he has ever judged, said Aragorn, good and ill have not changed since yesteryear, nor are they one thing among elves and dwarves and another among men. It is man's part to discern them, as much as in the golden wood as in our own house.
True indeed, said Eomer, but I do not doubt you, nor the deed which my heart would do. Yet I am not free to do all as I would. It is against our law to let strangers wander at will in our land, until the king himself shall give them leave, and more strict is the command in these days of peril. I have begged you to come back willingly with me, and you will not. Loth, I am to begin a battle of 100 against 3.
I do not think your law was made for such a chance, said Aragorn, nor indeed am I a stranger, for I have been in this land before, more than once, and ridden with the host of the Rohirrim, though under other name and other guise. You I have not seen before, for you are young, but I have spoken with Eomund, your father, and Théoden, son of Thengol. Never in former days would any high lord of this land have constrained a man to abandon such a quest as mine. My duty at least is clear, to go on. Come now, son of Eomund. The choice must be made at last. Aid us, or at worst let us go free, or seek to carry out your law. If you do so, there will be fewer to return to your war or to your king.
Eomer was silent for a moment, then he spoke. We both have need of haste, he said. My company chafes to be away, and every hour lessens your hope. This is my chance. You may go, and what is more, I will lend you horses. This only I asked. When your quest is achieved, or is proved vain, return with the horses over the Entway to the Medusild, the high house in Edoras where Théoden now sits. Thus you shall prove to him that I have not misjudged. In this I place myself, and maybe my very life, in the keeping of your good faith. Do not fail.
I will not, said Aragorn. Alright, that was cool.
Yeah, so I feel like even though they just were rolling right into the specifics of what to do exactly in this instance, but this whole exchange where Aramir is like, you know, how shall a man judge what to do in such times?
I know, it's nothing, great. I love this
nothing
part.
Makes sense anymore. And, I mean, first of all, it's an interesting reflection. Like, we've talked a little bit about the Riders of the Rohan being more relatable, normal, not tied up in this world of like magic and mystery that we're a little more familiar with the elves. And so you can see like the role that like history and mythology has in dealing with the weirdness. Like if you understand the stories, even if you don't totally believe them, you have context on which to like judge and act when things are not as normal as you think they are. But also Aragorn gives his response like, well, you still make the same judgments you would otherwise. Good is good. Evil is evil. It was yesterday, it is tomorrow, and it is for elves and men and for dwarves.
So Tom Shippey has this quote. He says, for all its antiquarian knowledge and antiquarian charm, no one could mistake that Lord of the Rings for anything but a work of the 20th century. It shows above all the difficulties which that century has created for traditional views of good and evil. You know, remember, in the 20th century, we're seeing unparalleled levels of death and destruction that's never literally been imagined before. Okay? Though it also tries to reassert them. Aragorn says to Eomer, good and ill have not changed since yesteryear, nor are they one thing to elves and dwarves and another among men. It is a man's part to discern them. But we may feel as much sympathy with Eomer's uncertainty and with his question, how shall a man judge what to do in such times? So like, yeah, again, this is like the darkest hour, like the normal men, like what are we facing down here? Like this is, how are we supposed to go on? Like which path? And Aragorn's just saying, yeah, we all have our moral principles basically, and those don't change depending on the time and situation. It doesn't matter when strange things are happening. Like, yes, we have to just go on. They're unchanging and universal, not dependent on time or place. I love this little passage here. It's also, this is kind of funny too. Here's something that you'll see in Lord of the Rings, and you'll see it in Lord of the Rings, but it's true throughout history. Like ancient people, they were way better than us at like the hard virtues, like courage and duty and honor and like chastity and obedience and stuff. Whereas more so in modern times, we're better with like softer virtues like pity or mercy or like sensitivity and like being humble. Mm-hmm. And also interesting from this, Aragorn's really old. He says he knew Eomer's dad and the Théoden guy who we believe is the king based on hints that we've gotten.
Right.
So Aragorn's old. Because Eomer seems like another, you know, guy peaking the prime of life. Aragorn seems slightly past that, but
yeah, they're like different generations entirely.
Yeah. So Éomer gives them two horses for their journey and says goodbye. There's a cool part with Legolas hopping on the horse bareback, and then Gimli's just going to ride with Legolas. Éomer and Gimli have an enduring goodbye, but we don't have time for it. Okay, and so that was the Riders of Rohan for this chapter. First impressions, what's like the best historical people that they might have been like based off of or something?
Well, I could see it being the horse part and the landscape, something like Central Asian steppe. Like, I feel like that always brings to mind like horse people.
Yeah, it has to be a horse people have to be, you know, plains people. Right. So that's a good guess.
And then there's an element kind of like that quote you read at the beginning of Native American like horse mastery and like spirit of the land, a little dose of that.
And of course it's the Native Americans that are on the Great Plains as opposed to in the desert.
Right. It's a weird moment in history that we think of like Native Americans on like horses mastering the plains. That's, you know, that's like the brief amount of time between when horses were introduced and
by the Spanish accidentally letting them go.
Exactly. And then certainly, like, I mean, for a lot of the people we've met so far, I think you could find precedent in Anglo-Saxon and other either British or Western European mythology.
Yeah, that gotta be. Yeah, gotta be.
Anglo-Saxon and Norse mythology is like Tolkien's go-to font for inspiration.
Right. Well, so that's what I was saying before. Like, originally the Riders of Rohan were tentatively supposed to be bad guys. As soon as we meet them, they're actually good guys, and this is one of Tolkien's biggest sources to tap into. And that source is because these guys are Old English. These are Anglo-Saxon. You know, like, hobbits are slightly more modern English people.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are going to be the old Anglo-Saxons. So let's get into this a little bit, like, put some concrete details on this. The Riders call Rohan what? The Riders themselves, they don't really call it Rohan. That's kind of like
the Ritter Mark.
Right. So specifically the Mark, because it's like Rider Mark or something. Yeah. So the Mark. The meaning of this should have been easy before Frenchification of English to tell what that meant. Okay. So Tolkien has, or so Shippey has this quote. He says, among historians, the Central Asian kingdom of Anglo-Saxon England was invariably known as Mercia, its inhabitants as Mercians. Okay, so think of when the Anglo-Saxons have come over from migration after the Romans, like Roman Empire fell, then they're setting up mini kingdoms all over England. And the biggest one of them was Mercia.
It on the British Isles.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. If you watch Vikings like season 2 and 3, they deal with some crazy bitch queen. She's the queen of the Mercians.
Okay.
Fun note. Okay. All right. These must, however, be Latinizations of native terms. And indeed, the West Saxons, in whose dialogue most Old English texts survive, called their neighbors the Merce. Okay? So Mercians is like the Latin name for it. Merce is going to get closer to it, but that's also just still their neighbors. If their names for their neighbor's kingdom had survived, it would certainly have been, and this is the asterisk form of it, Mirk. Tolkien, however, a native Mercian, as he often proclaimed, would have had no trouble in translating this back into Mercian, removing the West Saxon pronunciation, and coming up with the asterisk word Mark, just pronounced simply Mark. So Rohan the Mark is supposed to be Mercia. There's this good quote, too, in Tolkien in the Great War, where he said, you know, this is where Tolkien grew up. Like, in the heartland of England is where Mercia was. So this is where Tolkien grew up. This is where he was stationed for training. This was once the heartland of Mercia, the Anglo-Saxon capital that encompassed both Birmingham and Oxford, and with which Tolkien felt a special affinity. Lichfield was the seat of its bishopric, and Tamsworth, a few miles away, was the seat of the Mercian kings. Pretty cool. Okay.
Also, there's a little extra note. When Éomer was talking about the Shadowfax, about the king's steeds, he mentioned that Shadowfax, the most precious of all the king's steeds, chief of the Miras, which only the Lord of the Mark may ride, which sounds somewhat similar to some of these words you're tossing around. So
yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
I feel like that could be an additional little tidbit reference that Tolkien may have thrown in.
Possibly. Okay, but speaking of horses, though, well, I just would ruin it. One thing about the Riders that would not resemble historical English ancestors, take a guess. I just ruined it.
Horses.
What about them?
That they're riding them?
Right. So the Old English did not ride horses.
Okay.
Apparently, and this sounds ridiculous, but apparently this is true. Apparently, they're pretty sure that Anglo-Saxons would sometimes literally ride up to battle and then dismount off their horse and then charge on foot. Bizarre,
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, you can see, even though that sounds so weird to us, with the benefit of looking backwards, it's possible that their horses were, like, workhorses. You know, they couldn't necessarily gallop super fast and might not be very agile.
Okay, possibly. But anyways,
and
then,
I mean, also like, you, in the context of, like, military development, it's so weird for people sometimes to reconsider, like, the benefit that they might have from charging on a horse. Like, for them, they might just feel like it's so much more cumbersome than being able to fight on foot.
Well, they think this might have been one of the reasons they lost the Battle of Hastings to the Knights. So, I don't know.
Okay.
Actually, but Tolkien was not actually convinced of this fear of horses. So, this leads into another set of notes here. Now, admittedly, there is no English word for some grassy, plain flatland. We borrow words like steppe and prairie from other languages. Those are not native to English.
Okay.
Because England didn't actually really have any flat grassy lands. Like, it was mostly like downs and, you know, rolling hills a little bit, I guess. I don't know. I haven't been to England. But there were probably a bunch of like plains and prairies and steppe in the original Anglia. So, like, across the sea near, like, Denmark and Germany, like the original Anglia. The word that would have described them would have been emnet, okay? Remember, Eomer was using that word West Emnet.
Mm-hmm.
So Emnith is a real place in Northfolk. It probably derives from the Old English, and this is an asterisk word, Emmapith, or in modern English, that means even meadow.
Oh,
quite clearly the same idea as a steppe or a prairie. If the Old English had encountered a grass sea, they would have called it Emnet. Okay. And so, like, these fusions of, like, words and stuff, this is what gives Lord of the Rings, in Tom Shippey's words, dinosaur vitality, which cannot be conveyed in any synopsis, but reveals itself in so many thousands of details that only the most biased critical mind could miss them all. It is not a paradox to say further that the decentralized life is also at the same time nuggety, tending always to focus on names and words and things or realities which lay behind them. So it's like, yes, this is the kind of stuff that it gives it, like, a gritty, real feel. You know?
Yeah,
like, this is the heart of Lord of the Rings, is doing crap like this, and this is where Tolkien's the master above anybody else creating fantasy worlds, in my opinion.
It's also, I think, I mean, we've mentioned that the Riders of the Rohan are going to be a bit more relatable than Aragorn,
yeah,
for example. I think even if you don't understand all of this, the history and the etymology that Tolkien is working with, I think there's elements of the world that he's describing where you understand enough of it for it to feel familiar and unique. Like, you're able to envision this. It's not,
right,
it's not, like, fantastical in the sense that everything is, it's like on another planet, you know? It's not completely alien. It's like you kind of, you recognize the historical threads tracing through it.
Right. A couple other examples of this too. I guess the Rohirrim at some points will call themselves the Eothed. And so Eo just means horse in Old English. Mm-hmm. And Thed means people. So they're like the horse people or the riders, you know, because who else rides horses but people that riders, right? And then in the Sindar language, Rohan means horse country. I think Eo, Mir, I didn't quite look up what Mir was, but Eo is horse. And I'm tempted to just guess that Mir is man. So he's just horseman. So it's like, oh, the first person from Rohan that we meet, look at that. He's just called horseman. You know, how fitting.
Right.
Another example, Arid. I don't think we quoted it, but anyways, that's an asterisk word that means mounted troop, you know? So maybe the ancestors of English, you know, because that word comes from some sort of Old English roots or something. Maybe the ancestors of English, therefore, weren't as hippophobes as later records suggest, apparently. So hippophobe, horse, you know, phobia, fear. Their descendants, after all, have been passionately hippophiles ever since. So, like, yeah, and this is kind of fun, too. Tolkien, when he went to war, they had some sort of horse training with it too, and he was known as the guy that would break in the horses, you know, like everybody just, if they had a tough horse, they'd give it to Tolkien and he could, like,
really
it,
interesting,
you know? Yeah,
that's not what I expected from his personality, but that's
that's kind of the answer to why horses. That's my only real guess, is like, I mean, you have a great plane, so it's like, well, horse people dominate planes. But then I think it's also like Tolkien loved horses, as he loves other things in nature that we'll see throughout this. Also, funny note, this is just a complete side note, but it's too funny. So when you read the Iliad, one of the main characters in this is Hector. You know, he's the greatest Trojan. And so, like, they all have epithets, or they're kind of like nicknames that go with their name, and it's basically just to fit the meter of the line why they put these things in. But they always say Hector, Breaker of Horses. And so I did, when I was reading that, I totally was under the impression that it's not, you know, Hector was good at breaking in horses and taming them. I totally assumed it was like Hector's good at chopping horses in half. Anyways, that was a total side note. But yeah, Riders of Rohan, they're pretty fun. Tolkien tried to make the bold claim. He said, you know, the Riders of Rohan, according to Tolkien, like, they did not resemble ancient English, except in a general way due to their circumstances. A simpler and more primitive people living in contact with a higher and more venerable culture, occupying lands that had once been part of their domain. So what he's referring to is the Anglo-Saxons came into Roman Britain, and Rome was like a more sophisticated, higher culture. And then they're just a more primitive people that like lived off the land and then had contact with the Roman world that was left on the continent.
Okay.
And then Rohan, it's the same deal. They got the lands from Gondor, and then now they're friends with Gondor, and Gondor's like a more higher learned historic people. But fat chance that these guys don't have any Anglo-Saxon connections. Like, yes, they're basically just Anglo-Saxons who love horses. Of course, Tolkien puts all these cool Tolkien details on it, so it's not like, I wouldn't say the Rohirrim are a complete ripoff of Anglo-Saxons. I think Tolkien, you know, he takes that and then he makes his own and pays homage to it. I think that's enough of that. Should we blow through the rest of the chapter just so that we can get to the fun part?
So Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli take their leave. They've got horses.
Yeah. So they go to that battlefield where they had fought the orcs the night or the morning before, and they find the grave
mounds. Where the Riders of the Rohan had fought the orcs.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And so they find the grave mounds of the dead Rohan soldiers who have a nice grave, and then the burning pile of orcs. Gimli gives up hope at this point, and he says Elrond was right that the young hobbits shouldn't have come. But Legolas points out that Gandalf had said they should. But Gimli then counters, and he says, like, well, Gandalf died himself because his foreknowledge failed him. And Aragorn's got that good quote there. You want to take it?
The Council of Gandalf was not founded on foreknowledge of safety for himself or for others, said Aragorn. There are some things that it is better to begin than to refuse, even though the end may be dark. But I shall not depart from this place yet. In any case, we must here await the morning light.
Dude, Aragorn bringing it every single line in this chapter. Awesome. But let's not talk about it. We just got to keep going. Okay, so they camp out. It's cold. Gimli wants a fire. But Aragorn says, I'm not going to allow you to touch the trees of Fangorn. I have a feeling that we're going to go in there tomorrow. So Gimli makes a fire out of dead wood. This seems to please the trees because they're swaying in an interesting way. And then Legolas asks Aragorn if he knows anything about the legends of Fangorn. Or like what Boromir might have heard in Gondor. And then Aragorn's got this answer here. I'll take this one. I've heard many tales in Gondor and elsewhere, said Aragorn. But if it were not for the words of Celeborn, I should deem them only fables that men have made as true knowledge fades. I had thought of asking you what was the truth of the matter. And if an elf of the wood does not know, how shall a man answer?
You've journeyed further than I, said Legolas. I've heard nothing of this in my own land, save only songs that tell how the Unadrim, that men call Ents, dwelt here long ago. For Fangorn is old even as the elves would reckon it.
Yes, it is old, said Aragorn, as old as the forest by the Barrow Downs, and it is far greater. Elrond says that the two were kin, the last strongholds of the mighty woods of the elder days, in which the firstborn roamed while men still slept. Yet Fangorn holds some secret of its own. What it is, I do not know.
Foreshadowing for future chapters coming soon.
Okay, so from there they draw lots for watches. I love the term drawing lots. Best way to say gambling. Okay, and so Gimli goes first, and then there's this kind of important part that we gotta read too.
Suddenly Gimli looked up, and there, just on the edge of the firelight, stood an old bent man, leaning on a staff and wrapped in a great cloak. His wide-brimmed hat was pulled down over his eyes. Gimli sprang up, too amazed for the moment to cry out, though at once the thought flashed into his mind that Saruman had caught them. Both Aragorn and Legolas, roused by his sudden movement, sat up and stared. The old man did not speak or make a sign.
"Well, father, what have you come for?" said Aragorn, leaping to his feet. "Come and be warm, if you are cold." He strode forward, but the old man was gone. There was no trace of him to be found near at hand, and they did not dare to wander far. The moon had set, and the night was very dark.
Suddenly, Legolas gave a cry. The horses! The horses!
The horses were gone. And so at this point, they kind of discuss for the last page of the chapter what they think they saw. They're pretty sure it was Saruman, which is extremely creepy. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of just where they leave off at the chapter.
Because they heard mention from Éomer that Saruman goes about in a cloak, kind of like Gandalf used to, and right. stirs up trouble.
And they know that they're close to Isengard at this point, too. Mm-hmm. And with that, it is time for movie review. 10 out of 10 movie. I love this thing. I don't know if Clipper enjoyed it as much as me, but I thought it was awesome. What'd you think?
I enjoyed it. It was pretty fun. Well, just to be clear, we're talking about Chariots of Fire. Movie from 1981. I believe it won Best Picture.
It did. And it deserved it.
For those of you not familiar, are you going to give a synopsis?
Oh, I didn't write it down, but...
Okay. It's set in the UK in the 20s in preparation for the 1924 Olympics. And it follows a few different characters, partially at Oxford, right? Or is it Cambridge?
So one's at Cambridge, and that's Harold Abrahams, who's this Englishman, notably Jewish, that's very important to his character. And then, yeah, he's at Cambridge, and he's trying to just be the best in his class, the best at everything, mm-hmm. really. You know. And then the other main character is Eric Little, who's this Scottish guy who's torn between going to the Far East to be a missionary, like a Christian missionary, or whether he should just continue his running because he's really good at it. And yeah, so those are the two central characters. It follows both their stories in the lead up to it. It's a great movie. This is, if you really don't know what we're talking about yet, obviously I've already played the song by now. I have to have played the song. It opens with that scene where they're running on the beach, mm-hmm. and that is easily in the top 10 most iconic movie scenes in all of history, mm-hmm. period. Like, whether you watch the rest of the movie or not, everybody knows that scene, and it's awesome.
Yeah, it's also super goofy. Just, it's a bunch of funny-looking British guys in white t-shirts and white shorts running barefoot through the water, making
okay,
weird faces.
Have you ever seen such a shitty day look so romantic? That was pouring rain, and the waves were up, the wind was howling, and, like, man, I want to be out there. I don't even like running anymore. Like, running's hard uh-huh. now, but, like, I want to be out there.
Yeah. Like, yeah. There's another scene in the movie. Barefoot? Another scene in the movie where Eric Little was speaking to some fans after one of his races, and it's pouring torrential downpour. And only, like, half the people have umbrellas. And they're all standing there, yeah. like, at 70 degrees, like, watching intently. Yeah. Maybe that's just how it is.
So what I also like about this movie is the movie highlights and covers a lot of the time pretty well, but you gotta be, like, looking for it. Like, it's very detailed like that, but they don't explicitly, like, treat you like you're an idiot and lay stuff out for you. Like, you kind of just gotta be, like, the little nuances of how they get from scene to scene and, like, what's the motivation in this stuff, you kind of gotta pick up yourself, which is fun and good.
It's also, I would say, in terms of, like, general plot, it's not like a typical narrative trajectory where we have, like, exposition and climax and, like, it's a little bit more of, like, a historical perspective that's different pieces overlaid, and so it has, from a narrative standpoint, it's a little more low-key. Like, you have to be kind of patient to understand what's going on, other than they're just building up for this big race.
And I thought that was, like, a product of it being a weird 80s movie.
Yeah, maybe,
but
so.
I don't know. Okay. Oh, also, last interesting note. The Italian coach, the Abrahams guy, he gets a coach at some point. Mm-hmm. The Italian coach was played by none other than the same actor that plays Bilbo in the Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, no way. That's mm-hmm. really funny.
Yeah, it is pretty fun. Okay. All right. So a couple topics that we want to hit here. I knew I'd be playing the song in the episode, and then I just thought, like, well, you know, that's a good movie. You know, it shows academic life in the 1920s. I mean, Tolkien was an academic in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just, you know, do a movie review too to have more grounds to play the song.
And the initial reason you thought of it was because it's all about running, and Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are running for this whole chapter.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Right. Yeah. Okay. But anyways, like this does give a pretty good glimpse into post-war world and college life at the time. I had some thoughts about that I jotted down. I don't know. Should I go first? Do you want to go first?
Yeah, you go for it.
Okay. So first thing I wrote, these people, like, you know, they're sitting down for dinner at the college with all their professors and, like, all the new students and everything. They're all dressed to the nines, looking super studly, super uppity. And, you know, you get the vibe that these people are all WASPs. Like, WASP being white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestants, okay? It goes without saying, everybody in the room's a man. Mm-hmm. Everybody's white. You know, again, most are Protestant and rich. Like, Tolkien was the exception that he was not Protestant, and then he was the poorest guy in school. Like, he needed his scholarship. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Most of these people, they're coming from very, very well-off families.
One of the classmates of Abraham's, the runner, is a lord himself.
Yeah, oh, I love that one. I love that guy. He's my favorite. He we'll get to him in a little bit. Yeah, I don't know. They really just seem a lot more stuck up, mm-hmm. too. Like, you can feel, like, the high, flutant air that they all have.
Right.
Additionally, too, what you'll also see is there's a scene at the beginning of the movie where the wounded veterans are basically their bag boys, like, shoving their bags onto the trains and cars for them and everything. And the vets, like, you know, they have, like, deformed faces and whatnot. You can see that they hate working for these rich kids. Like, they don't really like their lot in life at this mm-hmm. point. Also, what you see too at the Olympics is it's all Western countries dominating. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they're the only ones really involved. This is a side note. The college educated scientists and professors at this time, they really did assume that the perfectly average white male was the perfect specimen for all sports. Mm-hmm. Pretty stupid, because I don't think that could be more wrong.
Yeah.
Also, not a surprise that that's the idea that came out of the rich white intelligentsia.
Right. And I mean, from an athletic standpoint, there's plenty going on there, but just from, like, an Olympic athletic standpoint, what you're saying is kind of like it was the same body type, same individual who might be racing horses and running a sprint and a marathon and playing rugby and doing any other sport you could think of was, like, the white male athlete was kind of just, like, one prototype.
And that idea might actually be related a little bit to amateurism, which I want to hit after mm-hmm. this, but staying with the college scene, because those are, like, kind of those are the negatives that luckily as society kind of evens out more, like, more people besides just the rich upper class men mm-hmm. have access to these kinds of things. So I loved the fair. They're walking around picking out which clubs to join, and it seems like everybody's joining multiple clubs, and they're all setting themselves up to be, like, mini Renaissance men, right. Like, good at a bunch of stuff. Like, Harold Abrahams, he's not just the star runner. He's also writes in the newspaper, which he's mostly just writing articles about himself, which is pompous.
Yes.
But he's also starring in plays, you know, and it's like singing all the songs, like all the show.
Right, he joins the acapella, like, group. Oh, it's later great. In the movie, he breaks into expert piano and singing solo.
Yeah, like that Englishman montage. That was a great scene, especially he's running around in, like, a sweater and ascot going training and stuff. It's like, also, back to, like, the perfect athlete kind of thing. Like, these training methods, these people are sprinters and they're going for, like, all these long runs and stuff. It's just like, this is such rudimentary training. Like, mm-hmm. it's pretty close to laughable, but I still admire, like, all their hard work that they're putting into this stuff.
It is laughable that they're wearing, like, dress slacks. and dress shoes for a lot of the races.
Well, yeah, or like the one in the courtyard. Uh-huh. But yeah, but it really does kind of feel like Abrahams is coming in here and he's literally about to set up shop. Like, he's setting up a factory where he's just going to produce all these achievements and productions, and he's just going to show off for the school. And he's doing it. Well, we'll get into his desires in a little bit in a second here, but he's doing it, and he's, I don't know, he's going to go all out with it in just many different fields. You know, not just his athletics and running. Mm-hmm. Also, the part where the college students, you know, compare this to us now. Now, I know that we are probably too degenerated as a culture that we only go to, like, sporting events and a movie theater, but It's still pretty exceptional that these college students are going to, like, this fancy play and sitting in the balcony, you know, in these tuxedos, watching like all these high class movie stars of their time, mm-hmm. you know, these great play actors, mm-hmm. like just there. And that's just, it just seems like that's a normal Friday night.
Right.
I mean, like, that's insane. Maybe it was a little bit above like the normal Friday night, but like nothing, you know, maybe the highlight of the semester, but definitely not like highlight of the year or anything.
Right.
Like, it's just something that they did, mm-hmm. which is funny. Next thing that I thought was cool, and again, like how these all kind of relate to Tolkien, it's just like, this is academic, you know, this is 1920s life.
Mm-hmm. At Cambridge, and he was at Oxford, right?
Right, which is the biggest rival, uh-huh. yeah. So I really thought the amateur versus professional little tension was pretty interesting there.
Mm-hmm.
So the context of this is, Abrahams is having a dinner with, like, the deans of his college or something. I don't really know who they are. You know, snotty, bigwig, stuffy professors.
Mm-hmm.
And they find out that he has a coach, which is very bad, apparently. Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some sense, this is kind of like what we hear today with the NCAA. Like, he's a college athlete. They're saying you can't really be competing on a professional level beyond the bounds of this school's running team.
Well, the NCAA's problem with it is it's like the most vestigial form of what they put down here. Like, if you're ever wondering, like, why were the Olympics always with amateur athletes up until the 80s,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, watch this scene in the movie, because they kind of explain it. So what they're saying is, the deans are saying, we love our athletic prowess, we love having, you know, sports in college and everything, we think it completes the person's education, like, it creates character, fosters discipline, leadership, and fraternity, and, like, those are all excellent qualities. But that's basically all athletics should be. You should not be doing it for pay. Like, you're not a professional tradesman, because tradesmen's looked down upon. You know, if you're doing that, that means you're selling your craft, and you're basically like a sellout. Mm-hmm. You know, and the university, they believe in the amateur way to achieve the best results. And I, you know, when you look at it that way, that does actually sound pretty noble. You know, like, I like that idea. Don't sell it out. You're doing it purely for the pursuit of excellence in itself, not for material gain or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really do like that idea. You know, this amateur kind of Renaissance man, you know, like, each club and each pursuit is just another extension of your overall character. And it's what's, like, shaping you into, like, a man in this mm-hmm. case. Or, you know, woman down the line mm-hmm. when they can do sports. But, yeah, I really love that idea. But doing that at the highest level in any of these fields, those times are gone, like, and they will not return, which is kind of sad, but I mean, that's just reality,
right,
you know? And Abraham's, his motivation is, he does all this not so much to build his character, but to be the best, to have the best character of any of his peers. You know, he's going to win, he's going to follow the rules and win within the rules, and he's representing himself and his family and his university. Probably what drives him is, like, his family background is that he's not the typical WASP. You know, he's not the Protestant. He has, like, the Jewish background, and you can see that reflected in mm-hmm. his name.
And he's consistently put down or kind of looked sideways at by...
He's still slightly an outsider. Like, he's not a true Englishman.
Right. And the people give him the side eye very often. So I think he explains that he basically feels that he has to be beyond perfect at everything he does to make up for yeah. the fact that people are always going to put him down because he's Jewish.
Yeah. And so, like I just said, the days of the amateur are basically over, and that's how Abrahams ends this conversation with these deans. He says, "You want victory, but with no effort," mm-hmm. which is a very cutting remark, in my opinion. Like, mm-hmm. that was, like, ooh, devastating line. He's saying
that their vision is, like, this vision of a British lord who struts out to the lawn and happens to be great at sporting and then can return back.
Right.
You know, maybe kind of in the fashion of Abraham's colleague or team member, the guy who is actually
the Lord. Lord. Yeah, that's Lord
and
Lindsay.
Is very casually interested in hurdling and happens to be really fast.
Yeah.
But that's kind of maybe the vision that the deans have in mind, is, like, this nonchalant gentleman performer.
Right. But Abraham calls out, he's saying, like, you guys are, like, on a playground here. You know, I represent the future of the pursuit of excellence. And, I mean, he's dead right. I mean, 100 years later, yes, look at this. eventually you got to the point where you had to become a professional because it encompasses so much of your time. And at the very least, you need to just make a living so that you can pursue that full time, you know? Mm-hmm. And so like at the very least, you're becoming a professional off of that. And then eventually, you know, you can pursue excellence and then, hey, money comes with it. And that's just mm-hmm. nice. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's what it kind of evolved into.
And also if you choose not to pursue it full time, you just can't compete at the level that everyone right. else is.
Right. So we still get the amateur idea in high school. And then for most college sports, that's true in college because they aren't like big money makers. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what'd you, this is getting slightly just more into the movie as opposed to anything related to the 1920s. But what'd you think of Abraham's character? Like, he was very driven because, like, again, like we were saying, he's kind of an outsider. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like he's, as opposed to pursuit of excellence, I think he would rather just settle on being the best as opposed to going the furthest anybody's ever gone.
Right, right.
You know the difference of what I'm saying? Like, he'd rather just look behind to make sure that everybody's behind him as opposed to getting as far ahead as he possibly could.
Maybe a little bit of both, but I think definitely...
Well, he's prepared to get as far ahead as uh-huh. he can. Because that's what he thinks he needs to do in order to make sure that he's ahead of everybody yeah. else. But he's more so looking back to make sure he's in front than looking...
Yes, highly, highly competitive and, like, very self-judgmental yeah. of himself. Like, he has kind of a hissy fit when he loses for the first time in a really long time. He's like, I never lose. If I can't win, I don't even want to do this. And certainly, yeah. at least in our modern context, comes off as, like, very egotistical. Or maybe not... A lot of athletes, I think, would have a similar harsh view of themselves, but certainly his ego is a player, and yeah, he's doing it with like intense competition in mind.
So especially when he gets to the Olympics, he has a rough go in the prelims, but he qualifies for the finals mm-hmm. in the 100, and so he's nervous because he got beat in the prelims, and then he has that scene where he's just like he fears losing, but now he's also frightened even to win. And I'm wondering, like, do you think it's because when he wins, like, and he does win, and then there's no celebration? Do you think like he felt empty when he got to the top because he did make it so that like yes, I achieved it, I'm the best. But mm-hmm. like, do you think he just finds it weird, like, all right, now it's just time to go to normal life, and that was it? Or like, do you think he feels unfulfilled almost?
Maybe.
I couldn't quite tell. I feel like that's where it's like this movie's nuanced and the watcher has to kind of figure it out for himself.
I read it as like his fear is sort of like he's always playing this mind game with himself against his competition that all of a sudden he just like second guesses himself. And it's meant to cast a strong contrast against his team member and competitor, Little, who's like very wrapped up in his own head and his own motivations and is kind of like aloof to the competition. Like, he's driven by this yeah. this amazing desire to run super fast, and he like doesn't even care about looking at what anyone else is doing. So I think it's meant to be like in this moment of intense competition, Abraham's like he doubts himself a little bit because he's always looking at everybody else.
Well, let's move on to that other guy, Eric Little, excellent protagonist, great hero, real life hero. If he were part of like the Catholic Church, he probably would be canonized, would be my guess. He's probably a saint either way. I also felt like he was kind of like in an Aragorn mold where he's like, you know, he's a pretty perfect character, no real flaws, even though he has lots of adversity to overcome mm-hmm. or like lots of hard choices to make, just like what we're seeing at this time with Aragorn in the books. Pretty cool. But yeah, I loved all his speeches where he's saying after the race, because he's a very religious man. You know, he talks about the strength to win a race and having faith are like, you know, they're both hard and they all come from like the same source. And like the source is basically like the Lord will help you and provide for you and mm-hmm. get you through. Like the most notable thing that he keeps saying is like, when he runs, he feels God's pleasure, and to win is to honor him. When I heard that, I had to keep listening throughout the movie, but I feel like this is kind of like a form of the sub-creation that Tolkien loves so much, you know? All right, God bestowed these gifts on me, I'm going to use them to the max. And it's like, first of all, he was actually like a really ugly form runner. Like, he like looked disgusting when he would run at the end because he had his arms doing some weird thing.
His head would flail back.
But he was so fast, and I did love that about this movie too. How just like the crowds just appreciated pure athleticism. It's not like there's any strategy to any of these races. They're just sprints, you know? And it's just like they just loved going out there to just see great athletic achievements. And Eric Little was the best of them all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cool. That was great. His biggest conflict in this, what arises is he refuses to run on Sunday. Like, he's just like, the Sabbath's the Lord's day. I want to honor him. I'm not going to do that. But one of the prelim heats for his race at the Olympics is on a Sunday. So the whole Great Britain Olympic Committee tries to get him to, forgo his oath and run on the Sunday, just because it's like, it's a prelim, mm-hmm. Just get through it. Like, they even bring in, apparently, like, the Prince of Wales to appeal to him, like, king and country, instead of God. Like, follow them. Like, help us out, Like, you're the best guy here. Come on, can you do this for us? Which, I found this highly ironic compared to the dinner with the deans that mm-hmm. Abrahams had, where they thought Abrahams was kind of selling out. Now they're literally asking, the government's literally asking Little to sell out, become basically like the tradesman, like the hired gun for their country, so that they can,
like, won't you please give us a show, can't you make an exception,
right? But Little totally committed, like, nope, I'm not doing it. And he doesn't compromise on his character there. Like, just like how the Cambridge student was going and doing all these things and it was just an extension of his character and like building it up, so was running for Eric Little. Like, first and foremost, he was like a man of God, and if running helps out with that, he feels God's pleasure in him as he runs fast, that's great. But he knows that God doesn't want him to run on Sundays, and so he's not going to mm-hmm. compromise that part of it. And this, that really does, lead to great praise from, some of the committee members. They're actually, happy that he didn't back down on that, because it shows he's a man of, principle and virtue, and, everybody mm-hmm. loves him even more, And then, luckily, a teammate comes in at the last second and says, well, I already got a medal, so, he can take my spot in the 400 if he just wants to run that, and that way he can still win, because mm-hmm. that doesn't compete on Sundays. Yeah, I don't know. I thought he was great. I thought that was such a fun movie. All of that. You have any favorite parts?
Well, besides running on the beach.
Yes, of course, besides the initial scene.
Oh, shortly after they join the different clubs, running around the courtyard.
Oh, I know. I love that part. That was my second favorite part.
There's supposedly ancient challenge at the university to see if you can run a full loop around the old cobblestone courtyard in the time that it takes the clock to toll 12, ring 12 times.
So you got 40 seconds or something.
So it was it's totally unscientific, but pretty cool challenge.
No, it was based on a real thing.
Well, I believe that it was a real thing, but it's not a real distance or a real time measurement. It's just like this old tradition that you have to beat the bell tower.
But the real one too, though, they were actually trying it for 7 centuries. they were attempting that kind of thing. But yeah, it was fun. I liked this might have just been fan service, but I thought the Americans were so cool. I thought we were so much less stuck up, and we make the British just look old and the has-been thing. Mm-hmm. Even though the main characters are British and they succeed in this movie, I thought the Americans were looser, more dynamic, definitely paving the way for the future. Again, that might have just been fan service because they knew they'd have an American audience, mm-hmm. but whatever. Oh, also, I love the part where he had the balls to ask the actress out during intermission. That was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. but besides the courtyard and besides the first scene, by far my favorite scene is when that Lord guy, Lord Lindsay, mm-hmm. he's having some sort of lunch out on the green on the lawn,
right.
And he's wearing some fine trench coat, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden his friend leaves and he takes off the trench coat.
So a little bit more like a bathrobe than a trench coat.
Yeah,
a really high quality bathrobe.
Yeah, even better. And so he has all his servants, set up his hurdles for him, and he has them pour a glass of champagne on each hurdle, and he's just like, now when I jump over these, if I spill one drop, I want to know about it. Mm-hmm. And he just proceeds to go do that. It's just like, how can you get more extravagant and superfluous?
Uh-huh.
like that's truly a peak. That was worse than anything in Downton Abbey for just way too extravagant.
yep.
Oh man, what a great movie. I love that
uh-huh.
one. I think that's all I got though.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, dude. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
great movie. Alright, I think we can leave it here then. Awesome job. Everybody check it out. It's so great. It's like $3 on Amazon to rent.
Yeah, it's easy.
So, ending Clifford. This was the Chariots of Fire episode. We just did the whole, like, half-hour review of it. I actually thought this episode was one of our better ones. Like, because we were actually concise with, like, the actual chapter part.
Uh-huh.
And it was a pretty big chapter, and it was a really cool chapter. And then we just made it really long by putting on the Chariots of Fire.
Well, good. Yeah. Hopefully everyone goes out and watches it now, if they haven't already.
Right, seriously. Come on, it's the best. Yeah, okay, so one of the things we were talking about in the movie review was how the people running the Olympics and then all, like, the university people, they all wanted amateur status of their athletes. Like, they just wanted to be, like, to complete mm-hmm. their well-rounded individual, basically. But then we were talking about how, like, well, eventually it was kind of inevitable that professionalism mm-hmm. would kind of come, you know? Do you have any more thoughts on that? Because I was just thinking about that. Like, at the same time in the 1920s, like, I was reading this whole book about the history of Italian cycling. And in, like, 1924 is when mm-hmm. the first Italian won the tour. And they said he was, like, so poor. He had, like, a hunger basically almost just to be able to feed himself and, you know, like, actually make a living, you know. And so it's like, so he had more drive than anybody coming from, like, these wealthy families mm-hmm. and stuff who were just, like, the amateur status. It's like he needed this to survive, not only to actually train and everything, but just to survive. Like, that was his living, you know. So they thought he could dig deeper than anybody else, you know, any sort of these, like, kind of rich lords just playing mm-hmm. in sports.
I mean, I feel like it's only a matter of time with any of these things. As soon as things get competitive,
right,
guaranteed you're gonna have people who just can't sustain it unless it's unless they're making money off of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm sure we discussed this at length, but I feel like it was a pretty elitist attitude from the university folks and the Olympics folks, just to, even if they didn't think of it that way, just to build it around, yeah, people who are doing this recreationally, who have the spare time and resources to do this type of thing. And, I mean, anyone who's paying attention to this, I'm sure, is aware now, like, the debate with college athletes and should they be paid and that type of thing.
Anything else going on for you? This is already a long episode, so we can keep this short here.
No, not much.
When we were at the bookstore, I bought that Token book. I think it just came out. The Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, like, halfway through that one. Pretty good. Honestly, though, I'm reading this one just for pleasure, as opposed to having to take, like, notes through it like I did with the rest of these mm-hmm. books. So highly recommend everybody get it, because I probably won't mention too much stuff because I'm, like, reading it, thinking it's super cool, and then forgetting about it, especially since this guy, it's the John Garth guy. He's, like, one of my favorite Tolkien authors. But he's making some interesting connections that you wouldn't think were possible about, like, what's influencing Tolkien, but then it's like, oh, this is pretty solid reasoning. It's pretty cool. So highly recommend that book to everybody.
Cool. Well, I'm eager to hear if it factors into some later episodes.
Well, that's the thing. I'm going to have to remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah. Tour starts this Saturday. You excited, Clifford?
I'm very excited, but probably not as excited as you, Patrick.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm pretty...
What should I be looking out for?
Jeez.
It doesn't have to be a full prediction. I'm thinking, who are you rooting for, and what surprises are you hoping for?
I don't really, I'm only just hoping for, like, a really close, exciting race.
Okay.
There's only six guys, I think, that could win it. Thibaut Pinot, he's the great French hope. He crashed out last year. It'd be kind of cool to see him win. No Frenchman's won in, like, 40 years. I'd like to see I wouldn't mind seeing Nairo Quintana win it. He was, like, the first great Colombian of this generation who, like, really put them back on the map. And everybody thought he would be the first Colombian ever to win. But then he got upstaged last year by the 22-year-old phenom, Egan Bernal, who's probably going to win it again this year. He's probably got to be the top favorite, I'd say. But then there's the whole Jumbo-Visma team, whose whole mission is to take down –
Egon Bernal and his Ineos team. Should be pretty exciting. They got Roglic and Tom Dumoulin. Those two, they're going to be on fire. And then they got, and Wout van Aert's on their team too, and he's just going to be like the best helper. You know, if he didn't have to help them, he could probably challenge Peter Sagan for the green jersey. It's going to be excellent.
Okay,
cool. I'm making my Tour de France fantasy team right now that my bike team does for money. Last year I led the whole thing. From day one, I led the whole thing until the very last day, and then I fell to third overall. And I was gonna win like over $100, and then I got like my entry fee back instead.
Oh man,
yeah. But I don't know. It's kind of weird because you get a certain amount of subs, but you're still on a budget the entire time. So like, I gotta be strategic about when I plan these substitutions in advance and make sure I got the budget for it. It's pretty very complicated stuff.
Okay,
spending way too much time on it. Yeah. But yeah, I think, we'll probably have updates on that. Like, we're not even going to record during the tour, so I'm just going to be so focused on that. So. But yeah, I don't know. If you don't have anything else, I think we can just leave it here.
Okay. Thanks, Sean. We'll be right back.